we will pass the midterm. Okay, so you see here we are not slacking. There is no moment of break. Okay, and so I'm sorry, but the pace of this course is very tight. So this afternoon around 4 o'clock, we will post on the website the midterm, and the deadline for the midterm. Honestly, I don't remember. It's something like 7, 8. February 21. Thank you, Serena. So you have a lot of time to do it. Okay, now. Differently from the homework, there are two major differences about the homework. There are two major differences between the midterm and the homework. So that's very important everyone is clear. So the midterm is an exam. It means, so I'm not just want to make sure everyone knows what an exam is. Number one is I will grade it. And number two has to be done individually. Now, there is no way for me. And, you know, I could give an exam that you guys are stuck here for 2 hours, but there's no point because this type of course, you have to know how to do a data analysis. So this is why I gave you a take-home exam. But the exam has to be done individually. You're not going to do it with your friend, okay? Now, there is something I do from time to time, I'm sorry for the warning, but... When I'm grading, I get a sense that it's not been done individually. I randomly choose 5 to 10 people and ask them questions, okay, about the exam. So you might be the lucky one. I'm very friendly, but I want to have a discussion about the exam. Please do it by yourself, and so then we can. You know, and then if you get an email, we can have a nice conversation and we talk about what you've done. Okay. Again, if you get an email from me, it doesn't mean that I think that there is any problem. I choose randomly. Okay. So I just do air uniform in R 1 to 75, and 5 to 7 fortunate name come up, and I'll email you. Okay. So just to give you a little bit of pressure. Sorry about that. I wrote this transparency this morning just because I want to summarize where we finished last time, and I know that you're now working on these quite extensively. So basically what we did is we presented the two type of models. So where we are right now is analysis of longitudinal data for continuous outcome. And, I mean, there is nothing new on this slide that you don't have in your lecture notes. I just put it one next to each other, so don't worry, to desperate trying to copy. So specifically for the pigs data set, basically what we did, we connected the two type of models to analyze continuous data where they are correlated. The first one, it's called a marginal model. Why it's called a marginal model? Because we model the expected value of yij for the entire population. So sometimes also we will call marginal model also called population average model. Okay? And I mean, at every lecture I just had, you know, one more terminology. So basically means that we model the average with respect to the entire population. And so beta 0 plus beta 1 tj, it's basically this population average relationship between the outcome and time. And this particular situation we just model as a linear function of time. And now we know that the data are correlated. So y con I is the vector of our repeated measurements. For now, we are still keeping the simple situation where everyone is measured the same number of times. And one assumption that we can make is that the correlation structure is uniform. Okay? And so that is model number one. And when you fit this model, and you've already been fitting this model in this data, what actually you have used the command XTGEE with the correlation exchangeable. And what he's doing is actually estimating the weighted least square. And I'm going to tell you today, actually, what is weighted least square. And what he does, he gave you an estimate of beta 0, beta 1, sigma squared, and rho. And after that, basically, you know, you have a good sense of what's going on. And the good news is that estimates of beta 1, so the standard error of beta 1 will take into account of the fact that the data are correlated. In fact, if you look at the fixed data set, if I remember correctly, the standard error of beta 1 when the data are independent, so if you do ordinally squared, it was like 0.08. The standard error of beta 1, if you allow for uniform correlation structure, was something like 0.03 or something. So you get a much more efficient estimate of beta 1. Okay? And in this case, I mean, the relationship was so strong that you will in both cases, you will model, you know, you will reject the hypothesis of beta 1 is equal to 0. But if there was a borderline case, it would be possible that if you would ignore the correlation and use ordinally squared, you will get a larger standard error. You will conclude there is no relationship, when instead, because the data are correlated, you will get much narrower standard error. And so you will conclude more correctly. Why I say more correctly? Because that's what our autocorrelation function suggested, that beta 1 is indeed different than 0. Now, we have also introduced for the first time what is a random effect model. Okay? And now, the random effect models, we also call it a conditional model. Why? Because you see, there is a reason why I use the brown in differently than green. Because so we model the expected value of yij conditional to ui, which is a random effect. So random effect, it means this is a random variable, that we do not observe it. What we do, we assume that u con I has a normal distribution with mean zero invariance to v squared. So this one is a pig-specific curve, okay? So basically, this is why this is not a population average model, because this allows you to model the relationship between yij and time specifically for each pig. Okay? The only thing that we're allowing, though, in this situation, that's why we call this a model with a random intercept, because the only thing we allow is that each pig specific intercept can deviate from the population average intercept by this amount u con I. And v square is a measure of heterogeneity between pigs to give a sense of how much variability there is between pigs in their weight at time zero. Okay? And then zeta ij, it's the usual measurement error. Now, what it turned out is that when yij is a continuous variable, there is a mathematical equivalence between the marginal model and the random effect model. Because what turned out is that the rho, so you can fit this model with the command, you know, random effect of MLE, you will get an estimate of the two variances component, and the rho, which is the amount of total variance explained by the between subjects variance, is the same rho as this one. And so I show you one slide with some matrix algebra that actually what I show you is that if I take this average and I also take the expectation with respect to all possible value of random effect, so if you take the expectation of this part, the expectation of u con I is zero, so you get back your marginal model. And if you calculate the variance of this guy by allowing for the variability of u con I, you're going to get back to this covariance matrix. Okay? So this means that when you have a correlated data, there are two ways of thinking about correlation. One is to specify a model for the mean and then specify a model for the covariance matrix. Okay, marginal model on top, and then you specify a model for the covariance matrix. Or specifying a model with random effect. Why in this, so I mean, it is intuitive now why in this way we account for the correlation. You know, we account for the correlation directly by allowing this rho to be different than zero, right? Here, we are allowing for the correlation because we basically allow that each pig, the repeated measurements for each pig define a cluster, okay? And this cluster is really identified by this latent variable, u con I. And the v square is basically a measure of what is the variance between the clusters, and zeta ij is the variance within the cluster. So basically what we're saying here that there are a lot of things about this pig that we haven't measured. So there are latent characteristics of this pig that make the data, the repeated data for the same pig correlated. Okay? So when you specify a random effect model, and this is the simplest case as possible, basically it's a way to show that when you specify a model with a random intercept, you are indeed taking into account of the correlation of the repeated measurements within a cluster. Okay, and that's true for any random effect model. Every time you specify a random effect model, you account of correlation within cluster. Okay? In this particular example, the correlation is exactly identical to this. If we will have this model and we will allow, for example, a random intercept, so we will allow each pig to deviate, each pig specific curve to deviate from the population average curve, not only by the intercept, but also from the slope, we will model a correlation, but we will end up with a correlation matrix that is not equal to this. Okay? Yes? That's an excellent question. Excellent question. The answer is no. Beta 1, in both cases, beta 1 has the same interpretation because we are working with continuous data, okay? So in fact, and I'm so glad you asked this because in this particular example, beta 1 and beta 1 have the same interpretation. They are both population average intercept. But what we will show is when you're going to have a binary data, so if you will have the same two models, just identical two models, but here you will have the logit or the probability of yij. So let's assume that now, instead of measuring the weight, we measure, you know, if the pig very fast or not very fast, and yij will be a binary, then the interpretation of this guy and the interpretation of this guy will be different. And we will see that at the second part of the course. So for now, we don't need to worry about. And when you have a continuous data, the interpretation of the regression coefficients under random effect model and the marginal model, in this case beta 0 and beta 1, are the same. Any other questions? Next question, yeah. So what you're saying is that this model can be considered a special case of this model? Well, no. In this case, these are the same thing. These are two ways of writing up the same model. Now, both of these models can become a model for uncorrelated data. So let's assume, so this model can become a model for uncorrelated data when you assume the rho is equal to zero on top. On top, if you say I force rho is equal to zero, then you're assuming under the option one that basically you're going back to the standard linear regression analysis. In the second case, that will be true if you assume that v square is equal to zero, that there is no heterogeneity. So there is no cluster. Everyone is the same. So if you say that this square is equal to zero, so there is no variance, there is no heterogeneity, you can have identical equal to zero. And the only thing that's left over is sigma squared j. Okay? Okay, so now continue with very quickly, and I think now you have a very good sense now that in addition to the uniform correlation structure, we can use an autoregressive model, which is a little more general. And basically, let's assume that the correlation between a pair of measurements on the same unit decays towards zero as the time separation between the measurements increases. So in the case of the exponential correlation, we assume that the covariance between yij, yik, which is the element jk of the V0 matrix, okay? And it's extremely important that you realize that what this means. That is the element vjk of the covariance matrix V0. And we assume that it is equal to sigma squared times E minus C times the absolute value of the time difference. So what it means is that as the tj minus tk get bigger, so the difference between the two time points is larger, e to minus phi times this larger difference will be smaller, and the covariance will be smaller, and the correlation will be smaller. Okay? So larger is the time difference, smaller is the correlation. And that's, and we will see that actually we can use this model even when the data are not equally spaced. Doesn't matter because we can account for the fact they are not equally spaced because we can have the time difference. Okay? So if you have T1 is 1 week, T2 is 3 weeks, and T5 it's, you know, So if I have time 1, time 2, time 3, which is 1 week, 3 weeks, and 7 weeks, while in one case the time difference will be 2, and in another case the time difference will be 6, and then the other time difference will be 4, right? It doesn't matter because I'm just going to count for the proper time difference in the definition of the covariance matrix. Now, for now, though, that we are still trying to keep things simple, if we assume the data are equally spaced, so the time difference is always D, it's always 2 weeks, it's always 1 week, it's always 1 month, it's always 3 months, then we can rewrite the variance as a sigma squared times rho, half to the J minus K. Okay, so why this is true, I actually wrote it up here, just in case it was not obvious. So what we are doing is say, well, if tj minus 1 minus tj is always equal d, so what I'm assuming is that if data are equally spaced, then you can say that tj minus tk, you can rewrite as a d times g minus j minus k. Okay? So then, if you substitute this guy there on top, you can rewrite the covariance, jk, as a sigma squared e to minus phi dj minus k. And if you call phi equal to e minus, sorry, if you call rho equal to e minus phi d, then you can write it as a sigma squared times rho j minus k. Okay. So if you get an estimate of rho equal to 0.7, that will be the correlation between the two measurements at log 1. So sorry, when the time difference is equal to 1. So when this is at 1. Then if you want to know for that what is the correlation between a time 1 and a time 2, then it will be rho to the power of 2. And because rho is between 0 and 1, that value will be smaller. Okay? So, This is a more general way. So before, we always assumed this, the uniform correlation structure. Now we are allowing these elevated 2 to the time difference. Okay? As we have a correspondence between a uniform correlation model and a model with a random intercept, there is a nice correspondence between the exponential correlation model and what is called the autoregressive model of order 1. In fact, now you have already fitted in theta and typed XTGE correlation AR1. Why you use AR1? Okay, well, because actually this model has a specified in this way is also implying that what you are saying is that you can realize YJ is equal to a mean, which it could be our regression model. You know, you can think about, again, this could be beta 0 plus beta 1 TJ, plus an error, WIJ. But now, what we say is that the error are correlated. So the error around the mean at time J will depend on the error at time j minus 1. Okay? And this is going to be the usual measurement error where our rho is the same as this rho. Okay? So one way to think about it is assuming an exponential correlation structure. It's equivalent to assuming that the error at time j, it's influenced by the error at time j minus 1. And you see, that is a third way of thinking about correlation. Okay? So there are three ways of thinking about correlation, which are what we're going to go back now and think about approaches for modeling longitudinal data. The approach number one are marginal models when you directly specify a covariance matrix. Okay? And that is the more direct way of thinking about it. The second one is a model with a random effect, where you're allowing that the repeated measurements for each subject or for each pig are identified by a cluster. And the cluster is identified by this random variable, u con I, which is the random effect. Three, we allow that the outcome at time j depends on the outcome at time j minus 1 through the error. And that's all called transition models. Okay? So there are marginal models, there are random effect models, and models like these are called transitional models, or models have an autoregressive structure. And then we'll go back and forth with this terminology many times. So the autoregressive structure say that for data that rise over time, so I'm just writing up explicitly that expression that I had before you have a VJK, the sigma squared, J minus K, and that's how a covariance method is going to look like. So for data that rise over time, it is often reasonable to assume that the correlation between measurements that are close in time is greater than the correlation of measurements that are widely separated in time. So here, if you have the data are equally spaced, basically you're going to say the correlation when the difference between the time points is 1 is just rho, when the difference in time points is 2 is rho to the square, and then until rho to n minus 1. Okay, so this number is going to be lower and lower. So actually, this is the most appropriate model for the pigs data set, okay, that you have fitted already. So so basically, and I'm not sure if this is a this is in the right position of your notes, but it's somewhere in your notes. So what I was telling you that there are three different ways of approaching longitudinal data analysis. Okay? So, and you have somewhere. So just look at there and don't worry about it, because it is in your notes. So there are, so, and these were the three approaches that, that I was calling, and I was missing in my mind the terminology, a transition model, not transitional model. That didn't sound right. So there are three approaches, okay? So one is the marginal model, where these V con alpha are our uniform correlation model or exponential correlation model. A random effect model, where you allow for the random effect specific to each subject. And our transition model, where basically you model the expectation of YIJ conditional to what has done before. Okay? And what we have been discussing is that a marginal model with a uniform correlation structure is equivalent to a random effect model with a random intercept only. And a marginal model with an exponential correlation structure is equivalent to a transition model of this type, which is also called a model of autoregressive of order one. Now, when we say autoregressive, let me also clarify another thing. I say a model is autoregressive of order one when you say yij given yij minus one, yij minus, say, p, is equal to expected value yij given yj minus 1. And that's what I call AF1. So this is a model, so it's autoregressive of order 1 because it has a very short memory. It can't remember anything else that happened before yesterday. Does it sound familiar? It sounds familiar to me. Okay? So like if you ask, you know, what have you hit today, and you know, and then what was for breakfast yesterday, and you know, and what was for breakfast the day before, you have no idea. Then you are an autoregressive order one. Okay? If you can remember what you have ate for breakfast 7 days ago, right, then you have an autoregressive, you can model as an autoregressive order seven. Okay? And most of the time, we're just going to assume autoregressive the model of order one, because most of the time it will capture the correlation. And 90% of this course will always assume autoregressive of order one. Okay? So there is a correspondence between the exponential correlation model and model of with an autoregressive structure of order one. Okay, but you could extend it to all the paths. So in this case, I wrote this model in a very general form where I say what happened at time j can be influenced for what all has been happened, you know, in the past. Okay? But then when we say that the only thing that matters is what happened the time before, then it's just order one. Okay? So So let's see what are the important points, okay, of all of these discussions. So modeling the correlation and longitudinal data is important to be able to obtain correct inferences on regression coefficients beta, okay? And we have talked about marginal models because the interpretation of the regression coefficients is the same as in cross-sectional data. So it's the same interpretation that when you see a standard linear regression model, as you've done today, okay? However, you can think about the correlation by specifying a marginal model, which is basically the same thing of specifying the regression model, and specifying a correlation structure. But there are two other ways of thinking about correlation. Okay? And correlation can also be specified in terms of subject-specific models. So subject-specific model means random effect, or transition model. Okay? So we looked at assuming an exchangeable correlation model is an equivalent to thinking about a subject-specific formulation, specifically model with random intercept, and assuming an exponential correlation model is equivalent at formulating really the formulating an analysis of longitudinal data by thinking about a transition model. So what we will see, how we will move, you know, how we will continue to work on these problems, that there are really three elements that influence a correlation structure. And these will come clear as we will move in the next 2 or 3 weeks. So there are three things. So one are random effects. This concept that the repeated measurements for each unit basically define a cluster. And we need to take into account of the correlation within a cluster, as well as the variability between clusters. The second one, that there is this notion of autocorrelation of serial dependence. So what happened to the blood pressure today, it's influenced to the blood pressure measurement the week before. Because if there was not serial correlation, you can see that it's a good indication there is no correlation either, right? And then there is a usual noise on top of everything that we have in any standard, in any statistical formulation, there is always noise, okay? So far, when you did the standard regression, you always worried about this. Now, what we did, I show you two different ways. One, where you only worry about this and this, which is the uniform correlation, or you worry about this and this, which is the exponential correlation. But as we move along in the class, so we can model all of these three simultaneously. Okay? So we can account simultaneously for random effects, serial correlation, and measurement error. And we can get these V0 covariance metrics, which are really rich and complex. Okay? Now, one thing that I haven't told you yet and would be how we estimate all of these, okay? And so, so far we have been just thinking of modeling the correlation structure and then we will estimate it. But sometimes what we can do, we can also assume what we call working correlation model. So in some situation, we can make reliable inferences about the data without marrying a specific correlation model, without necessarily say my correlation structure is uniform or my correlation structure is exponential, but just using what we call working correlation matrices, okay? And there will be another way of accounting for correlation that would be after I will present weighted least square estimation. So we will go back to this working correlation model later on. So what I want to do now today is to talk about estimation. So what we need to do now is to digest how this data command gives you numbers. I mean, where these numbers are coming from, okay? And again, in other courses of, applied data analysis or applied longitudinal data, in other situations, people can completely skip about all of this. They just say, well, you have done a pig's data analysis, right? So you got numbers. Why you need to worry where they're coming from, okay? Well, so I'm worried, and for me it's important to tell you where they're coming from. And one time in your life, I think it's important to know where the process, because this is where knowledge is a higher level. So I can still justify my existence and teach the entire course, skipping this, by the way. So I'm not doing this because. stay with me, and I want to tell you what is weighted least square and what is maximal likelihood estimation. And as a general rule, I always want you to connect what type of estimation procedures data is using when give you the number. Okay? And even if you don't know exactly step by step how it's calculated, but at least the intuition of where this number is coming from, that will be something that's very valuable to get out of this class. So what we are assuming is, so this is our usual long vector y, and this is the vector repeated measurement for a particular subject. So what we're going to assume is now yi as a multivariate normal distribution, mean xi beta, and the covariance matrix to bi. Okay? For I equal 1 to m, these are the covariance matrices. So what we have been done so far, we assume that they are balanced, and we assume that every one of the same covariance matrix, the matrix is equal to V0, and I show you what happens when V0 is uniform and when V0 is exponential, okay? Now, what we will do later on, we'll say, well, what happens if they are unbalanced? Then you cannot make this assumption anymore because every person is measured a different number of times, so every person will have a different covariance matrix of different size, and so we will need to things more complicated. We specify two parametric models for covariance matrix, a uniform and exponential. That's what I mean by parametric. And we'll see that there's also another way that to leave this V0 completely unstructured. It means that I'm not going to specify any model. Now, what I'm going to do now, I'm going to show you how, I'm going to show you all different methods for estimating your parameters. Okay, so I'm gonna show you these four methods, and then we will do a quite, I would call it quite sophisticated and rich data analysis of the Sitka, the three data set. Okay, and so when we will get here, in, you know, we will use this data set as a template to really go into the nuts and bolts of every single model and how these parameters are estimated with respect to this method, okay? And we'll also include what is called robust estimation, okay? So I'm going to show you all the methods, and then at the end, we will bring, we'll do a data analysis. If necessary, we will dedicate an entire class all you to the data analysis and try to put all, everything together and summarize. So with the least square estimation, is it just that the immediate generalization of ordinarily squared. Okay? So basically, under this assumption, when the data are continuous, we also assume that they are multivariate normal. Okay? So the definition of n weighted least square is basically, so the weighted least square estimates of beta using a symmetric weight matrix W is the value beta tilde W which minimizes this quadratic form. Now when we had ordinally squared, if you remember the theory of ordinally squared, you know, the reason why I torture you with that, because what we did in ordinally squared, we estimated beta that minimized the same quadratic form without W. So the only thing we are doing now is weightedly squared is the same thing, but now we have to minimize the sum of square, which is weighted by W. And you can see that W will be one way to take into account the correlation. Okay? So if you need to minimize this form, the solution is written this way, this guy. You can see immediately from here that if we say that W is equal to identity, this guy is x prime x inverse x prime y. So this guy becomes the OLS. Okay? So weightedly squared is the direct generalization of ordinarily squared because it's a solution of a minimization problem, which is minimizing the sum of squares, which would be weighted by W. And what I'm doing right now, I'm just assuming that we know exactly what the correlation structure here is. Okay, we know exactly what is true. We have a W, and we're going to use this W to define this estimator. And this estimator encompasses the ordinarily square, where you assume that there is no weight. So you see, if you say that the W is equal to the identity matrix, It means that you are treating every data point in the same way. You are not weighting the different data points in a different way. Now, a nice property of this estimator is that this is an unbiased estimator of beta, independently of what is the choice of W. Okay? So what does it mean? It means that if you so let's assume, so this is the model, and let's assume you know a particular beta. Okay, so let's assume that the true beta is 5, and the V is a uniform correlation structure. And you can generate 5,000 data sets under this model. Okay? So well, you know exactly what the beta is, and you know exactly what the V is. And then you, every time you generate data set, you redo the, you recalculate the estimate. And you recalculate the estimate with this weighted least square. What happens is, independently how stupid is the choice of W, when you average it, you will go back to the true value. Okay? So the weighted least square is an unbiased estimate of beta. The unbiased is nice. Independently of how crazy is the choice of W. Okay? But that's not the point, though. Because what we want to do, we, being for an estimator, being unbiased is not enough. You also have to have a minimum variance. If you have an estimator is unbiased, but the variance is huge, it's going to be totally inefficient. Okay? Actually, sometimes in statistics, we are willing to compromise a little bit of bias to basically define an estimator that is a little biased if its variance is much lower. Okay? So generally, a good estimator in statistics is an estimator that has small variance with respect to this bias. So it's a very good compromise. Okay? But still, it's an important thing to know that if you have a correlated data and you feed a linear regression model, even if you completely are off with the correlation structure, the point estimates of beta, it shouldn't be too far from the truth, especially if you have a large data set. Okay? So that's what an unbiased estimate means. So what I was saying before is that now, you see, it's easily to reconduct, to redefine ordinal least square from weighted least square. So if you don't weight, if you assume that your weight matrix is simply sigma squared times the density, then our weighted least square is simply the ordinal least square estimate. Okay? And then the variance, and so this is going to be the ordinal least square estimate, and then you will get exactly the variance of the ordinal least square estimate. Now, one thing is useful, though, is that there is one way of picking W, which is optimal. Okay? And the optimal way of picking W is take the inverse of V. So let's start again for a moment. So what we're assuming that Y, that is that our continuous data, have a multivariate normal distribution with mean X of beta, and V is known. I mean, right now we know what is V. Okay, so V is a uniform correlation. So this is known. Okay, and what we want to do, we want to estimate beta so that it's unbiased as minimum variance. Okay, so one thing is true is that if you estimate beta by using weighted least square and picking W equal to V inverse, then you get the best possible estimate of beta. You get an estimate of beta which is unbiased. It's always unbiased. It depends on your choice of W, remember? But what is important is an estimate that has a minimum variance. And why I'm saying that? Because beta at will be the maximum likelihood estimate of beta. So what we will see is that, so again, you have this assumption, V is known, and you can write up the Lockwood function for beta. And you can find the beta that maximizes the Lockwood function. And that would be a maximal Lockwood estimate. And it turned out that the maximal Lockwood estimate is a weighted least square estimate with the W equal to V inverse. And so that is the definition of weighted least square. The only thing I did, I replaced W with V inverse. And then you can calculate the variance of this guy by taking this matrix times the variance of Y, which is V, taking the same matrix transpose as we've done it before, and that will be the variance of beta hat. Okay. So the most efficient weighted least square for beta use W equal to V inverse. Okay. So you see, actually things are kind of coming together, because what you want to do is, assuming that you know V, the best possible way of estimating beta is to use a weighted least square with W equal to V inverse. Why? Because it turned out that the particular beta with W equal V inverse is the beta that maximizes the Lockwood function. And so by definition, it's going to be an unbiased estimate of beta with minimum variance. So it means that this beta hat, this variance will be the minimum possible you can get among all the possible choices of W. Okay? So you see, it's a very powerful thing. So basically, I'm just going to... So if we assume that our data have a multivariate normal distribution with mean X beta and covariance matrix V, if someone told us what is the true V for now, if we know V somehow, and if we choose W equal to V inverse, then our beta F is the weighted least square estimate with minimum variance, because it's also a maximal Lockwood estimate. Okay? See someone with their eyes alike. Mm-hmm. Yes, please. Sorry, say it again? Yes. Yes. So you can actually, I think I have it here. Forget for a second what is a W. So just put aside from your mind what is a weighted least square estimate. Okay? Assume you know absolutely nothing about W. Okay? So, and let's start thinking about the problem a different way. So we have this model here. Y is equal X beta plus epsilon, and epsilon as a multivariate normal distribution, mean variance covariance matrix V. Okay? The same as before. Before, I just say that Y is a multivariate normal X beta V. Okay? That's the same way. And V is known, okay? So we don't need to worry about V. V has a uniform correlation structure with rho equal 0.3. Okay? So the only thing I'm worried about, I want to estimate beta. But I want to estimate beta taking into account of V. Okay? So in how we do that? Well, we do maximal Lockwood estimation. What we want to do, we want to find the maximum Lockwood estimate of beta. So because we have, by doing this, I specified a sampling distribution. I'm telling you the data multivariate normal. So I can write the Lockwood function for beta. I just take the density of a multivariate normal distribution as a function of beta. Okay? So if you go back to the theory of ordinal least square, I'm doing the same things only for the multivariate normal. So what I have here, it's the log likelihood of beta that comes from the assumption here. So how you get this? If you go on your book and look for the density of a multivariate normal distribution, just go and look it for me and take the logarithm, that's what you get. Okay? So this is the log likelihood beta. To find the maximal likelihood estimate, so we need to maximize this form as a function of beta. Beta is the only thing I care about. Okay? So of this form, the only part that depends on beta is this part. Okay, so maximizing the likelihood function means to minimize this weighted sum of squares. And the solution of minimizing the sum of squares is this guy. And guess what? Who is this? It's the Weyl-Li square estimate with W equals the inverse. Okay. You guys totally love. But come on, is this fun? Are you excited about it? Come on. So, please tell me something. I mean, are you like, should I start again? Should I give, I mean, ask questions? Like, if there is anything that you, or what I'm saying is totally unclear to you, or I mean, every, is it clear where we're going to, or no? So-and-so. So, okay. I'm going to repeat it one more time, and then we'll see maybe for the Wednesday, okay? So then I might give you a few homework, and then we'll come back on Monday, okay? So when you have, when we had ordinality square, okay? So let's simplify the problem for a moment. And as a general rule, the only way to see if things that can get easier is just to think it simpler, okay? So let's assume you have yi. So forget about longitudinal data, okay? Let's think about simplest possible linear regression. So you have yi is beta, I'm just thinking beta 1, x con I plus epsilon I, and epsilon I is normal 0 sigma square. So then you have the y con I as a normal distribution with mean beta x con I and variance sigma square, and sigma square is known. Okay? And what I want to do, I want to find the maximum likelihood estimate of beta. Okay, so everyone write up these three things. Okay? And then I actually want you to do it. I mean, I'm doing here now, but then I want you to do it. Okay? So how I find the maximum likelihood estimate of beta? The number one, I have to write down the likelihood function of beta. Okay? How I do that, the likelihood function of beta is the product for I equal 1 over n of the density function, which is a normal, okay? So it will be 1 divided 2 pi sigma square e minus sigma square y con I minus beta x con I square, okay? So this one is the density of a normal distribution. And I need to write this as a function of beta. And what we do often, we take the log. So our goal is to find the beta that maximizes this function. Okay? So what we often to do is to find the beta and maximize the likelihood function is the same as find the beta that maximizes the log likelihood. And by the way, this is the exact same stuff we did the last week on ordinality square. I'm not telling you anything new. So then what I do, I calculate the log likelihood of beta, which is going to be summation over I of 1, 2 pi sigma square, and then it's going to be minus summation over I 1 of 2 sigma square yi minus beta x con I square. this one is basically equal to a constant minus 1 to sigma square summation over I yi minus beta x coni sigma square. Okay, so what it turned out is that to find the maximum likelihood of beta, we need to maximize the log likelihood, and because there is a minor, we need to minimize the sum of square. Okay? And the solution of this sum of square is the ordinal least square. Okay? Now so, and just take some notes and try to redo it yourself, and try to go back to the ordinal least square notes. Okay? So, you have a model, you define a distribution, you define the likelihood function, and you find the beta that maximizes the likelihood function. And why this is fun? Because the beta that minimizes sum of square, being the maximum likelihood estimate, is unbiased minimum variance. Okay? So that is the thing. Well, what I show here, it's exactly the same thing. The only difference is now the data are not univariate normal anymore, are multivariate normal. And so the likelihood function, the log likelihood function of beta look different than what you had before, because instead of plugging in the density function of a univariate normal distribution, I plug in the density function of a multivariate normal distribution. But you see, actually look the same, because the bottom line is that you have to minimize the sum of square, and that is basically the same as before. It's just a minimizing a weighted sum of square. And the solution is this guy, which is a weighted least square estimate with W equal V inverse. So the beta hat that minimizes the weighted residual sum of square is a weighted least square estimate with W equal V inverse, and is defined in this way. That's the point estimate, and that is the variance. And under this assumption, this is the minimum variance that you can get with respect to all the possible choices of W. Now, if the data are independent, then V is equal to sigma square I. Now, if we assume here that V is known and is equal to sigma square times the density matrix, now what we get is we go back to our ordinal least square estimate. Okay. Now, you can also think about weighted least square as ordinal least square on weighted data. Okay? So, you see, we can rewrite this sum of square as basically, remember, this is a vector for all the I. So you can rewrite the same quadratic form by summing with respect to the individuals. And this one is the same as this one, where you have transformed the data in this way. So what we're basically saying is that if you know V, doing weighted least square is identical of doing ordinal least square, but when you have reweighted the data by taking V inverse times Y and V inverse times X. Okay? So that's why it's called weighted least square. So basically what you take your V minus 1 half, and then you multiply by your observed data, so you are reweighting your response and the covariate, and then basically, that's another way of taking into account the correlation, and then you apply ordinal least square. So the WLS is equivalent to the ordinal least square applied to transform data Y star and X star. And in fact, and I would like you to try, you can show that this one is equal to this. Now that you're very familiar with matrix algebra. And you can see why. You can rewrite V inverse minus half as a V, so V inverse minus 1 as a V inverse minus half times V inverse minus half. I'll do it for you. So this one, you can rewrite this x prime v inverse x prime okay. So you see this one is identical to this one. I just take v minus alpha and I split it in two. And then look at that. This is x star prime, this is x star prime, and this is y star. So that is equal to x star prime, x star inverse, x star prime, y star. Okay. Which is the ordinary square estimate for x star. So let's lower down a little bit the technical level of all of this, okay? And let's think what doing Weatherly square means. So what I told you is that Weatherly square is a generalization of ordinary square. And basically what we do, it's instead of minimizing a sum of square, we minimize the weight of the sum of square. And another way to think about it is that to do ordinary square on some data that have been reweighted, that have been transformed in a way that accounts for the correlation. Okay? So I'll give you a few examples. It's a very, very simple example. So let's see what is the interpretation of weighted least square when the covariance matrix is a diagonal, which means there is no correlation. When the covariance matrix is not a diagonal, if, for example, two measurements are highly correlated, and when V is not a diagonal matrix, and for example, you might have an autoregressive model of order one, so it means that V is an exponential correlation. Okay? So let's assume we know V, and let's see what, in a very simple calculation of weighted least square under these three assumptions. So let's take this very, very simple toy example, okay? Actually, what you can do, you can always write the likelihood function, right, from this model. So let's assume you just have three repeated measurements, okay? So you have y, which is equal to y1, y2, y3. You have a model which is simply an intercept, plus an error, okay? So you have one subject and three repeated measurements. And you assume, because it's a vector of dimension three, you assume that the epsilon has a multivariate normal distribution with mean zero and covariance D. Okay? We know V, and I'm telling you, V is diagonal, but there is something different. That V doesn't have the same variance to all three measurements. So what's happening is, I'm saying that the variance of the third measurement, is 10 times larger than the variance of the first measurement. So what is a concrete example under which this data could arise, okay? Well, let's assume you have, let's take the measure of weight. Well, actually, measure weight is. Just to have a lot of fantasy, we can go back to our blood pressure, okay? So you have a person that gets the first visit, and we measure the blood pressure the first time. Then he comes back at the second visit, and we measure the blood pressure. And then it comes back to the third visit, we measure the blood pressure again. So you have three blood pressure measurements, which are Y1, Y2, and Y3. Because of the covariance matrix is diagonal, we're making the assumption that there is a dot correlation between the repeated blood pressure for the three, right? But what we are saying that the variance of the third blood pressure measurement is much larger than the variance of the first two blood pressure measurements. And basically, a situation what could happen is at the third visit, there is another nurse who uses a very lousy instrument for measuring your blood pressure, which is much less precise than the other two. Okay? So, ordinally square, remember, when we do ordinally square, we make two important assumptions. We not only assume that there is a no correlation, but we also assume that the variance is always the same. So here we are violating one assumption, not because we assume there is correlation, but simply we say that the variance of the variance of the measurements of each visit might be different. It's a different type of measurement curve. So under this situation, if you have to calculate ordinally square, and actually that's another little exercise that you want to do, is that ordinally square, as I told you, is defined as x prime, x inverse, x prime, y. And what I'd like you to do is to show that this is equal to y1, y2, y3, 3, when x is simply a vector of 1. If you take a vector of 1 and you multiply for another vector of 1, you get 3, and then you remultiply for a vector of x prime. So basically, actually, this one will come up a vector which is equal to 1/3, 1/3, 1/3. Okay? So ordinally square, what they do, you know, if you take ordinally square, we're going to estimate beta 0 by taking just the straight mean of the three measurements. Okay? So you see, there is something wrong here, because we know that the third measurement is much louder than the first two. But because we do ordinally square, we assume that the variance is always the same, so we are not weighting the three measurements different. We assign 1/3, 1/3, and 1/3. Okay? When instead, if we do weightedly square, well, with weightedly square, we calculate Z inverse, and the inverse is going to be, so it is the inverse of the covariance matrix V, and the third element would be 1 over 10, right? We just take 1 over each element on the diagonal. Then the WLS estimate is basically our definition, but with x equal 1. And you see, you get a different estimate of the mean. You get an estimate of the mean where you get a lot of weight to these two measurements, and you almost disregard this third guy. It's almost you give a 50-50 here, and this one you don't care. Actually, if you here assume instead of 10, 100, well, you will give this weight 0.004. Okay? So you basically, these will count almost nothing. And you see, that makes sense. Because we know the third measurement is lousy. Okay? So that's why weightedly square allow you, when you estimate a parameter, in this case, the simplest case possible by taking the straight mean, by weighting the observation accordingly, by taking into account of how precise these measurements are and how correlated. Okay, so for now, we just assume that it was not correlation. So now let's take a different example. Okay, well, let's assume the same model as before, but now I have a different V, okay? So I'm assuming that the variance is the same over diagonal, let's say it's 1, so the three measurements are equally precise, but the blood pressure measurements of visit 1 and visit 2 are highly correlated, 0.9, whereas the blood pressure measurement of visit 1 and visit 3 are 0. Okay, so you see you have a 0.9 at 1, 2. So by making this assumption, we are saying that the correlation between y1 and y2 is 0.9. The correlation between y1 and y3 is 0. And the correlation between y2 and y3 is 0. Okay? So one of the example is that, and that's I think applied, you know, for guys only. So you get your blood pressure measure, and you know, and you have very nice looking nurse at the first and the second visit, and so the blood pressure will be highly correlated. Now the third visit, there is someone looking very differently and has nothing to do with the previous two. Okay? But both nurses use the same instrument. They are equally precise, okay? So again, if you do ordinarily square, you just take the straight average of the three. That's as before. The three measurements will have a weight one-third and one-third. And now I just show you the calculation that will allow you to calculate the weight least square. So how you do it? Well, the same thing. You invert the matrix. So in fact, you can check if you take the inverse times V, it's going to be the identity. This is the inverse of this. It's not going to be as simple as the other one, because when a matrix is a diagonal, the inverse is actually very nice because it's still diagonal and you have one over of each element on the main diagonal. When the covariance matrix is not diagonal anymore, then the inverse is a little more complicated, and that's what you have in your handout for matrix algebra. But anyway, believe me, this is the inverse, and then I calculate my weight of the square. So I do my little calculation, and this is how I come up with. So you see, it's interesting now because I split the weight between the average of the first two and the third. I almost assign equal weight between to this guy and this guy. I've kind of put these two together. And why? Because we know they are very correlated, right? So you see, you have a different type of weighting. Okay, so weighted least square is a way of estimating a regression coefficient by weighting the data in a way that will fully account for whatever structure is our V. And finally, if we take the step further, if you have just the repeated measurement for one subject, and you assume this type of V, so this is an exponential correlation model. It's nothing different than what we see before. I just call it theta instead of rho. And you want to estimate beta. You know that if you estimate beta by doing ordinarily squared, it's going to be wrong because V is very far to be diagonal. And so you want to estimate beta by doing weighted least square. And you know how to do weighted least square. You just need to apply the formula by using the inverse. Or another way to say that, as I showed you before, you can apply ordinarily square on this transformed data. Remember I told you that doing weighted least square is identical doing ordinarily square on this data transform. Well, it turned out, and believe me, that if you take this matrix, minus and half, and multiply by the data, these are the transformed data. So actually, in this case, there is a very nice solution because what's happening is doing ordinarily squared, so basically you can calculate You can redefine your data in this way, which is how you get it by multiply V minus 1 half times Y. And the doing weighted least square is equivalent over doing ordinarily least square to this pair. Okay? And also, again, this is kind of makes sense because remember, here we are modeling the correlation but just assuming that there is an influence of time j minus 1 on time j. So if you redefine your data as the difference between j minus 1 and j, basically you're accounting for the correlation by redefining your data point in this way. And so then you can calculate weighted least square by applying ordinarily square to this transformed data. So I'm wrapping up, and then Monday we'll start again. So what we've done today, okay? We tackled probably the most complicated, topic of the class, which is estimation when you have continuous longitudinal data, okay? And what I show you, I give you the definition of Waverly square, which is the natural extension of ordinally square, and I show you how you can do maximal likelihood estimation when your data are distributed as a multivariate normal distribution with a non-covariance matrix V. And I show that the maximal likelihood estimate for beta is indeed a Waverly square for W equal to B inverse. And that is our favorite estimate because of being an MLE is unbiased, it has a minimum variance. However, if you define a Waverly square, even if you misspecify W, a Waverly square estimate is always unbiased. However, if you specify W in a very wrong way, you might have that this estimate is terribly inefficient. Okay? And so then what we did is I also show you that doing Waverly square is equivalent of doing ordinally square on transformed data. Okay? So if you have Y and X, do WLS on Y on X is equivalent of doing OLS on Y star and X star, where Y star is V minus 1/2 Y, and X star is V minus 1/2 X, okay? It's the same thing. So basically, if you know the covariance matrix, you kind of gonna reweight all your data and apply ordinally square, and that's where you are done. Because basically accounting for the correlation means to reweight the data in a different way. So now what we are gonna do on Monday, we are gonna do an additional step where we're gonna revisit this argument when V is unknown. Unfortunately, we don't know V, right? Because when you do theta, it gives you an estimate of rho as well. So we need to go back to maximal likelihood estimation when both beta and V are unknown, and so show how you get estimates of beta and estimates of V simultaneously. Okay. So have a good rest of the week. Go take a nap.